This week on Making Contact.
When you're owned lock, stock, and barrel by the state of California and you're incarcerated, it's not like if you get sick, you can, you know, say, oh, give me a pass today. I want to go to the local emergency room. You can't.
Healthcare in prisons and jails in California is in a state of crisis. There is no quick fix, and lives are at risk. In the last of our three-part series, A Crisis of Care, A System on Life Support, we'll hear from experts offering an insider's view on the continuing healthcare crisis in California's prisons, including a former federal receiver, a whistleblower correctional nurse, and a former prisoner turned advocate. I also sat down with a longtime prisoner rights activist to discuss the state of prison healthcare and the potential for change. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Turn the dial in California, and these are some of the stories you might hear.
The healthcare system at CDC is sick.
In California, lawmakers are lamenting the state of healthcare in the state's huge prison system. And they want to know why a healthcare system that costs $1 billion a year is plagued with incompetent doctors and unexplained deaths.
For many of them, when they were on the street, healthcare was not their priority.
The case of an inmate who died after having his wisdom tooth pulled. Dr. Joe Bick says his staff could use twice as many nurses, more examination tables, and even something as basic as chairs. One inmate lawsuit recently labeled California's prison medical care as cruel and unusual punishment.
In the last several years, stories about gross medical neglect in our prison healthcare system have hit the airwaves. That's probably because in 2006, California's prison healthcare system was yanked out of the state's hands and placed into federal care. But medical neglect in California's prisons and jails has a long history. This next story is just one of them.
My daughter started getting sick. And I'm like, Gina, what's wrong? And you look so sad today. And she goes, Mom, I didn't want to worry you, but this menstruation doesn't stop. And she said, I have blood clots. And blood clots are coming out, and I'm begging them to please let me see the doctor. And they keep telling me to wait.
That's Grace Ortega. She's talking about her daughter, Gina Muniz. Gina was serving a life sentence for a nonviolent crime at the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla. While she was incarcerated, she got sick. She was in pain. Her stomach was bloated. She was bleeding uncontrollably.
It doesn't take you a doctor to see how sick she was. She needed medical treatment right away. And they kept telling me, nope, she's fine. And we did a checkup on her, and she's fine. And I said, no, you need to take my daughter out of there, and you need to send her out to a hospital. If I have to pay for it, I'm willing to pay for it. I'll do anything. I said, just give me the bill and I'll give you the money now.
Despite a mother's plea for help, it took 6 months and a painful ordeal before Gina finally found out just how sick she was.
She said, Mom, I have something to tell you. She said, why I'm sick. And she goes, I just got back from the doctor after all the testing and all the months that passed and everything. I said, oh, they found out what's wrong with you? And she said, yes. And I thought it was going to be an infection or something. And they said, no, that my daughter had cervical cancer. They found cancer on her, 2B. And I started crying. I said, what's 2B, Gina? Is it curable? And I remember just crying and crying. And she said, Mom, don't cry. She said, I'm going to be okay. It's treatable. It's in an early stage still, 2B. She said, the only thing that I'm not going to be able to have is any more children. And I said, you're right, Gina. She was supporting me with my... And I told her, yes, you're right. And I got a hold of myself, and she said she was going to get chemo and radiation for 6 weeks. And they were going to shrink the tumor, and then they were going to give her a hysterectomy.
But the hysterectomy would never happen. Instead, Gina was faced with delay upon delay until her time eventually ran out. Days before her death, Gina received a compassionate release so she could die at home with loved ones around her. That release was the only form of compassion she would receive from the state that locked her up for life and then carelessly took that life from her. Gina Muniz was 29 years old when she died on November 29th, 2000.
And I have all the documents with me too. I have every paper from that courtroom, what they put us through. Because one day I said, my daughter's story will be told. The way she was treated. Mm-hmm. And taking her life from her too.
The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, by all accounts, is in horrible shape. The courts have documented hundreds of cases of rampant medical neglect in the prisons, from unsanitary conditions to incompetent doctors who withheld prescription drugs from patients. On average, an inmate a week dies in California prisons from neglect or incompetence. Unfortunately, Gina Muniz was just one of many who suffered needlessly in a poorly managed medical system.
We've seen all of the prisons, essentially, in this, all of the adult facilities in the state of California, and it's just horrific.
That's former Santa Clara County Medical Services Director Robert Sillin. Sillin became the first federal receiver charged with overhauling California's prison medical system, a daunting task, to say the least.
What we really have to do is we have to change the entire system. It's a total system redesign. This isn't a tweak around the edges. This is creating a whole new medical care system within CDCR, because the one that they had obviously was illegal, immoral, unethical, and just very, very bad for the health care of the inmates.
This receivership stemmed from a 2001 landmark case, Plata v. Schwarzenegger. It was the largest ever prison class action lawsuit brought before the courts. The suit alleged the California Department of Corrections was violating our Eighth Amendment, which forbids cruel and unusual punishment. Ample evidence presented in the case showed widespread medical malpractice and mismanagement. U.S. Federal District Judge Thelton Henderson heard the case. He delivered what many called a stunning verdict. Judge Henderson agreed with the plaintiff. He said the prison health care system was, quote, broken beyond repair, causing an unconscionable degree of suffering. California's prisons would now be under a state mandate to clean up its act. But several years passed, and no significant changes were made. That prompted Judge Henderson in 2005 to create what would be the single most powerful post overseeing CDCR's medical care, the California Healthcare Receivership. The appointment was unprecedented in the history of U.S. corrections. Sillin was given that post a year later in 2006.
These prisons, many of them, especially the older ones, but some of the newer ones, are filthy. For instance, there are no hand washing facilities in clinical space. And therefore, as documented by the court experts, some physicians and other providers not only don't wash their hands between sticking them in the mouths of patients or touching patients, they don't even change their gloves sometimes. So it is not very difficult whatsoever to just visually see the horrid, horrid conditions. And that's not even including the overcrowding, where each of these prisons is 200% or so of occupancy. And then as one talks to both custody people and to medical people, it is quite evident very quickly how hopeless and helpless many of them feel, because they don't get the support, there isn't the infrastructure to make the changes, they don't get financial support. The culture of the prisons is as horrid as the medical care, and is one of the reasons for how bad the medical care is, because basically the body politic in California and the general public just don't care.
Sillin is right. There are probably many people who don't care about the more than 1.5 million people behind bars.
They have this imagery of these individuals in state prison all being rapists and pedophiles and murderers, without taking a second to realize that about half the prison population, in fact, are nonviolent offenders. About 150,000 parolees are busted each year and sent back to prison for 2, 3, 4 months. It's an utter waste of taxpayer money. It's an utter waste of human life. But nobody ever tries to sit down and say, gee, we do it wrong here in California, even though in almost every other state in the country, they've figured that out.
But whether people are in for violent crimes or nonviolent crimes isn't the issue. Providing health care is. It's in our Constitution, the Eighth Amendment to be exact. We as a society are required to provide care for those we incarcerate, regardless of their crime. That means, Every time someone dies from medical neglect in prison, or every time the state denies someone in prison appropriate health care, we, the people, are violating our own laws. Cillin agrees.
When you're owned lock, stock, and barrel by the state of California and you're incarcerated, it's not like if you get sick, you can, you know, say, oh, give me a pass today. I want to go to the local emergency room. You can't. You're in that prison and you're not going anyplace. So it's the state's obligation and responsibility for people under their control, and I use that term advisedly, who don't have any options, to take care of them, not just in terms of medical care, but in terms of their other health and welfare needs. And that's what the Constitution of the United States is all about.
Robert Cillin was removed as federal receiver shortly after we spoke. His replacement, J. Clark Kelso, took over the post earlier this year. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org.
I was in the visiting room. Two officers here. I'm sitting here having a visit. I hear something over here at the end. The girl was on the floor, couldn't breathe. Two guards that are supposed to be watching the visiting room. I yelled something you're not supposed to do, and you know, as an inmate, I yelled at them. I said, you need medical now. Grandmother was visiting her in the wheelchair. Grandma goes into a heart attack. Okay? The girl died of an asthma attack in the visiting room. The grandmother made it. But what? Because she was an inmate. Because she was behind prison bars. A young girl died. Because they didn't want to get help to her fast enough. That's what is happening behind the walls of the prison system.
Dee Garcia is a former inmate. She was incarcerated at the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla, the same prison where Gina Muniz died from untreated cervical cancer. Dee was at Chowchilla's skilled nursing facility, the only facility of its kind in the state. It's where some prisoners with severe medical conditions serve their time. I interviewed Dee at her home in Orange County, California. She was in her hospital bed, surrounded by oxygen tanks and medical equipment. Regardless, Dee's house is warm and welcoming, just like her.
I have high blood pressure. I have our heart condition where when my lungs, if I get pneumonia or I get a very bad cold, I get water around my heart. And then I have degenerate disc disease in my back. My bones are crumbling. I have none to very little cartilage in my knees and hips.
Dee was a very sick woman when she arrived at Chowchilla. Serving time for credit card fraud, she soon became an outspoken critic of the facility's healthcare system.
I was an advocate that would not shut up. I was a person who was human, wanted to be treated as a human being, and I was appalled at what I saw.
In prison, sitting in a wheelchair, her oxygen close by, Dee spoke to the media and prisoner advocacy groups about the deplorable medical conditions she witnessed and experienced firsthand.
Now, when they took me out to the hospital for tests, they would put the shackles on me and handcuff me, you know, with the chain around the waist and the handcuffs. But they were so heavy that my feet would swell. In fact, they couldn't get the cuffs around my ankles, so they quit doing that. And they just started putting cuffs around my wrists.
Chowchilla is the largest women's prison in the country, designed to hold about 2,000 women, but as of September 2007, more than 4,000 are said to be there. Besides overcrowding, it also has a reputation for providing grossly inadequate medical care to prisoners. Complaints of medical neglect date back to its beginning in 1990, culminating in the 1995 landmark case, Shumate v. Wilson. The case was settled before it went to trial, with California agreeing to make substantial medical upgrades at Chowchilla and California Institution for Women. But in the years that followed, prisoners, prison rights groups, and correctional nurses say changes were barely detectable.
It took 30 years of lawsuits against the state of California prison system to bring out the horrors, the absolute horrors of what is going on in this prison system.
That's Joey Upland. She has more than 30 years' experience as a correctional nurse.
California incarcerates more people probably than any state in the world. And there's no end to how our desire to continue to incarcerate. And the task of providing care to people that are locked up in prisons that aren't even built to accommodate health care is one of the problems. And people die in these prisons all the time just from lack of health care.
Joey is in her early 50s. More than half of her life has been devoted to the care and fair treatment of California's prisoners. Warm and engaging, but wearied some by what she knows and what she's seen. Joey obviously has sacrificed a lot to do her job and advocate for change.
I have a bachelor's of science degree in nursing, and in lieu of a master's degree, I went through a 3-year program to become certified by the American Bar Association as a legal nurse consultant, working on correctional issues. So for 7 years, I have worked in litigation on wrongful death cases in jails and prisons. And they're just more stories of the true horrors of what we've become and what happens in some of these prisons.
One of these horror stories is a case she knows well, the story of Gina Muniz.
When Gina's mother, Grace Ortega, came to the California Nurses Association, to our correctional nursing advocacy group, and asked us for help, when she told her story, I could not stop crying because her story is so typical. And I have seen what happened to her daughter happen to thousands and thousands of people in the state of California prison system.
Joey says there's a clash of cultures within the prison walls that leads to those all too common cases of illness and death. On one side are the nurses who are trained to view the patient's health as the top priority, while the corrections officers have a different agenda.
The big conflict, I think, with custody is they interpret behavior entirely differently than I do as a nurse, because they put themselves in a position of viewing medical care the way they want to see medical care. They have a hard time differentiating that they are not medical people. They have no right to make those determinations. And they do because they're security. So somehow in their thinking, they think that they get to interpret everything. So the conflict comes when I directly tell them that this is what needs to be done, and they directly tell me that they are not going to do what I ask them to do. And everything changes at that point. So I think also that officers have a very hard time seeing care being given to prisoners because they only see them one way.
As do a lot of people.
Most people have only the media news view of prisoners. People are led to believe because they see the most sensational stories, the worst stories, and the worst of crimes, and that's their only impression. And in reality, most people who go to jail and go to prison are doing relatively short sentences, and they're coming back out into society, like I say, I think the bottom line is we need to provide drug treatment in this country. And we have yet to deal with that problem or find a solution to that problem. And I think that they are the basis of most crimes. And we just have not been able to look at that in a way of providing healthcare and seeing healthcare as part of the solution.
Former prisoner Dee Garcia agrees.
If you put the money into programs that deal with addictions and put the people into programs, you will get productive citizens out of it. If you continue to put your money into building more prisons, you will get more prisoners.
It's a sunny morning in San Francisco as I make my way downtown. I am meeting Donna Wilmot at the fourth floor office of Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, or LSPC. It was Donna who played a key role in winning a compassionate release for Gina Muniz, coming just 2 days before her death in November of 2000. Good-natured and focused, Donna has spent more than a decade defending the basic rights of prisoners. She offered her unique and experienced insights on the multiple problems within California's prison system and the potential for change.
I'm Donna Wilmot, and I am a family advocacy coordinator at Legal Services for Prisoners with Children in San Francisco. LSPC is an organization that advocates for the rights of people who are in prison and their families and people who are at risk for incarceration. And we do a variety, we have a variety of projects ranging from All of Us or None, which is a project to defend the rights of formerly incarcerated people and to lessen the barriers that people face when they come back from prison.
What do you find that most of the women are in for?
By and large, the majority of women who are incarcerated in California are in for nonviolent crimes. Some of them are about drug use, which in my opinion ultimately is an expression of the need for self-medication after histories of abuse. 80% of women who are in prison were victims of either psychological, physical, or sexual abuse before they were incarcerated. Many women are doing time for drug-related offenses that have a lot more to do with their relationships with their partners, their boyfriends, their husbands, activities than their own. Economic offenses, writing bad checks. A lot of the things that women do are done to survive in the face of an economy in which women are more and more marginalized in communities of color. A lot of times there's just no jobs and people do what they need to do to to feed their families. I mean, I'll never forget interviewing a young mother who was 27 years old. She's an African-American woman and she was sentenced to a third strike, and her third strike was stealing $34 worth of baby clothes from Kmart. And this woman, was going to do 25 years to life for Pampers and onesies for her baby. I mean, this is insane. You really have to ask yourself what kind of a society we're living in if this is considered an offense that you pay with for the rest of your life.
What are some of the solutions that Legal Services advocates for then?
Well, we feel like there has to be a process of decarceration in this state, that it's insane to spend so much of our state budget. It's both about the financial cost and about the human cost, but we feel like more and more prisons are not the solution, so we feel like there has to be a process of decarceration and also of a refusal to expand the prison system. We believe at LSPC that community safety lies in people having housing, having job skills, having education, that those are the things that will keep us safe. If we do not have a whole segment of our population basically locked out of whatever good things this society has to offer, and that if we deal with that from a human rights standpoint and remind ourselves that these are things that every human being has a right to, and that we systematically have denied those rights to whole categories of people. And until we make those changes in the structure in our society, then we're always going to have people who will be the scapegoats. And that's, you know, primarily people of color, immigrant populations right now. And you look at the prison systems and, you know, people say prisons are, it's the largest public housing in the country. This is where poor people are being forced to live because there's not public housing, you know, that really meets the needs that are out there. It's the largest mental health institutions. 10% of people in prison have mental health issues, serious mental health issues. Prisons are the largest battered women shelters, but it's not really a shelter and it's not a safe haven. It's just, it's the place that houses more women who have suffered battery and abuse than any place else. So we see this pattern of prisons becoming this so-called solution for all these social ills. And it's easy to do it because it's invisible and people are kept away from our communities and we don't have to walk over them lying on the street, you know, sick and addicted. You know, we can just shuffle them into the jails and the prisons and think that we've done something, but we haven't.
Unequal justice and unconscionably poor healthcare. Far too often, a system, fueled by tax dollars and regulated by laws, fails to provide even the most basic health protections for prisoners. And while federal authorities have finally undertaken the task to end the chaos, true change is not happening anytime soon. Some estimate that results are still a decade away. And the plain fact is, there are many other Dee Garcias in the system right now. Other Gina Munizes who don't have the time to wait for justice and their most basic human rights.
It's up to the public to know the truth. And it's up to the public to either listen to what we are saying that have been there and help turn things around. Go spend a day as an inmate and you'll really know what I'm talking about. Go spend a day as a sick person in prison. And then I want to see how much you complain when you're out here.
This concludes our three-part series, A Crisis of Care. Many thanks to all of the people who contributed their time, energy, and support to this show, especially to freelance audio producer Mike Lamar, to Matt Fidler of Fidler Sound and Media, who wrote and produced the music for this series, and to Steve Macer for editing assistance. Special thanks to Larry Pattis for use of some of his music for this show. Much appreciation to the Omnia Foundation, who helped make this show possible, and to Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast Crew. For a CD copy of this program, please call 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer producer, Puck Lowe associate producer, Elena Buck and Levy intern, and I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.